Nothing in this program should be considered investment advice. It is for educational purposes only. Please hit pause and read this disclaimer in full.
And the math has always been the math. And there's we call it the end of the great Keynesian experiment. There's a point that's coming where this debt-based system just can't support itself anymore outside of just this increased perpetual motion machine that's a money printer.
The following is the audio version of a video released at peakprosperity.com. Visit peakprosperity.com to watch the video and to find other insightful content such as articles, discussion forums, and exclusive subscriber-only content.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to this episode of Finance U, where we help you understand what's going on in the world of finances and monetary issues. No better guest than today. Good longtime friend of mine, Craig Hemke of TF Metals Report. And we have so much to go into. Craig, welcome to the show.
Chris, it's just such a pleasure to visit with you. It always is. And
always is.
I've considered you a valuable friend for over a decade. I mean, like 14 or 15 years now. And look at us now. We're not aging or nothing. We're just, you know, as youthful as we've ever been. These markets will do it to you, that's for sure.
Well, it's been a long and patient, if I might not say suffering, wait, especially for us silver folks, because my first purchase of silver was back when, if it moved a nickel a day, that was a big deal. 2001, $4.58 an ounce. I remember when I bought in. And then 2011 happened, and it looked like we were off to the races, but oh, that was just another 14 years we had to wait, apparently. So why don't we start there? What are you seeing going on in silver right now?
Well, silver is an interesting story, as it, you know, the whole little brother thing to gold. I think that, you know, there's a lot of different spokes to the wheel, you know, about the derivatives and how many times silver is levered and how much silver there really actually is to be delivered in London, you know, which is still the physical delivery hub of the world. And there are all those kind of things that we could go into great detail about. I think at the end of the day, right now, it's trading as a reflection of gold. You know, the gold chart's been pretty predictably moving higher for about the last 2 years. It goes up 15, 20%, it goes sideways for 3 months. It goes up 15 to 20%, it goes sideways for 3 months. And as we record this here on Tuesday the 2nd, it broke out again from a most recent about 4 month sideways consolidation. So is it ready to go up another 15%? And if it does, it leaves the people that actually trade the futures contracts kind of scratching their heads going, well, geez, Louise, this gold-silver ratio, you know, gold's at $4,000, then what should silver be? And it kind of takes on a little bit of a life of its own in that silver, as we all now know, will sit there and do nothing for long periods of time. Is it, Chris, you would know this better than I, is it Newton's law of inertia and physics and all that stuff that says an object will remain at rest until a force is applied to it, right? That's what silver kind of is. It just will sit there and lollygag and drive everybody crazy. And then once it starts to break out, you get this kind of fear of missing out trade that kicks in. You know, people are like, oh, yeah, gosh, look at this going. And it just starts to catch fire on its own. And that's kind of what it's doing now. Now, once it gets really going, and that may not be until next year, we'll see. Then all the other stuff, you know, how much physical silver is there really in the world to deliver against all these derivatives and future promises and unallocated accounts and everything else? Then we might get to find some of those answers. But for now, it's breaking higher again, along with gold. And that's probably the biggest part of the story.
Well, I took it personally for a while watching the shenanigans happening in the paper markets, right? You know, it's like, come on, guys, gals, hands off, you know, take your foot off the throat of silver. But the truth is, corn farmers aren't doing any better. Oil is like, it feels like the whole commodity market just got taken over by the CFTC just failing to regulate, the CME failing to regulate, so that there's so much paper action in these places that the signal that should exist between a producer and a consumer is swamped by the paper signal, right? And ultimately what that means is we've had, if this is year is going to follow in the footsteps, we're going to have 7 out of 7 years with a structural shortfall in silver where less is being produced than consumed.
Right.
How do you not have a price rise under that circumstance? It's bizarre.
Yes. And you can, you know, when you contrast it to corn, right, or some of these other commodities, you know, the commodity markets were initially set up to have a place where these producers could sell forward their production at a, you know, a number that they could do business at. And then those contracts are out there traded by speculators, you know, betting on it to go higher or lower. That's where they're originally supposed to go, Chris. And now, you know, there's too much money in it for these bank trading desks and hedge funds and the like to maneuver prices in a way that they can profit. Now, corn, you could say, okay, well, look, corn's the same price it was 10 years ago, you know, $4 a bushel or whatever. And, well, that's okay because, yeah, the cost of everything going into it has gone up. But, hey, we produce almost twice as much corn per acre as we used to. So, okay, maybe you can kind of figure out a way why corn and wheat and soybeans are still where they've always been. But silver, like you said, is a different animal. The last 4 years have seen a supply deficit of somewhere 700 to 800 million ounces globally. And we know that those supply deficit numbers are going to increase as the world electrifies, you know, solar panels, you know, batteries for electric cars, you know, all these. Silver is such a great conductor of electricity that that demand for silver, physical silver, is going to increase. And again, against that backdrop is this pricing scheme that relies upon the trading of not actual silver. God's sakes, no, we don't want that. We're going to trade these futures contracts in London and New York that are supposedly backed by silver and deliverable in silver. We're going to treat that as the real thing. And what we don't know in the end is how many actual ounces there are with free, clear title that can be delivered against all of these obligations, these futures contracts and forward contracts that these financial institutions have created. It's a little bit like the audit of Fort Knox. Remember back when there was this talk back? Yeah, remember that?
I'm old enough to remember that.
You can recall that, huh? Yeah, remember, yeah. What was that, February?
February.
Where you had not only Musk, but and Trump mentioning it. Remember Rand Paul fired off a letter to the Secretary of the Treasury and said, I'm a sitting U.S. senator. There's only 100 of like me, 99 others like me. The Fort Knox is in my state, so I'd like to know. And it's just crickets. So it's a little bit like that, you know. How much gold, I mean, U.S. says we have 8,133 tons. But do we really have it? Do we have it? Is what we have under clear title, or has it been leased and loaned and hypothecated, as it financial terms are, or rehypothecated?
Yeah.
That's what we don't know.
Well, I have a model for this. So if there's a police involved shooting, if it's a good shoot, you'll see the video that day. If it's a little iffy, might be years. Again, they might have lost the thumb drive. It might have to get FOIA'd out, you know, and then it's like that. So if all the gold was there, they would just throw the doors open, invite everybody in, and they'd point at it, and they'd say, look, here it all is, right? They're being cagey about it, not because it's an issue of security. We know how to get people in and out of secure facilities. That's not a big deal. You can get a senator. It's like, not, there's not something special about Fort Knox. You know, you open some doors, and there's guards, and you let him in, and he walks around. It's easy, but they make it sound so hard, like, oh, well, we'll have to get back to you on that, you know, if ever. So, hypothesis, the gold isn't there.
Mm-hmm.
What happened to it? If it's not, what would you just speculate? What happened to it?
It's like the story about a decade ago where suddenly Germany wanted to repatriate their gold that was held, I guess, at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. Remember Die Hard 2 with the guys that showed up try to steal it all? And so as Germany was first told, yeah, oh, no problem. You can have your gold back, but give us about 10 years.
It was just 300 tons, right?
Right.
Out of thousands.
It's right here underground, and you need 10, something about, hold on now. You know what I mean? It's the same kind of thing. And then when they started getting gold back, it was all these like new bars and coin melt bars and things like, they're like, what is going? So it's kind of like that. Where is the gold? That's the question. Now, there have been some folks that have done some excellent research on this, that actually the gold in the Federal Reserve Bank of New York or out of Fort Knox was actually shipped off more than 3 or 4 decades ago. So I don't know. If we are headed where I think we're headed, then there's going to need to be some sort of accounting of how much gold the U.S. actually has. And that's what spurred this discussion of auditing Fort Knox in the first place 6 months ago. So we'll see if that story kind of develops legs again as we get deeper into this year and next, because if I'm reading the tea leaves right, if I'm connecting the dots right, then there's going to be a reason for letting everybody know how much gold the U.S. has. For what Trump's and Bessent's plans are to trying to manage a deficit and buy Bitcoin and do all that other stuff.
The markets are a ticking time bomb. Volatility is spiking, trade wars have broken out, and most investors are sleepwalking into disaster. Many portfolio strategies perform poorly during times like these. At Peak Financial Investing, however, we don't gamble with your future. Our registered investment advisory connects you with battle-tested wealth managers who reject outdated models and embrace active management, strategies proven to navigate chaos, and who aren't afraid to discuss things like the great taking or maybe the importance of protecting your wealth with gold. Without the right approach and with the wrong advisor, you're risking, well, everything. Don't wait for the crash to act. Visit peakfinancialinvesting.com right now to schedule a free consultation and discuss your particular situation. Take control of your wealth before the markets take it from you. Again, that's peakfinancialinvesting.com, and I'm Dr. Chris Martinson, urging you to act now. You and I have been tracking this for well over a decade, I know, of just watching the flow of gold from west to east, meaning from U.S., Europe, Switzerland in particular, recasting those kilo bars, all going to China, never to be seen again, right? I feel like China's been playing a game of spoons, you know, that game you play where you're playing cards and there's a set of spoons and you have to sort of see if you can sneak one out of the middle. I think China's been like sneaking spoons out of the middle, right? And now people are starting to catch on a little bit. And there might come a moment where they just clap their hands and it's like, that's it. How much gold is inside the border of your country has a big role in how valuable your currency is going to be and what you can do in terms of trade. So I feel like, was anybody, did we lose our gold to China?
Conceivably, yeah, that's right. I mean, that's why Nixon closed the gold window in the first place, right? We went from 25,000 metric tons at the end of World War II with the only manufacturing economy that was viable in the whole world. And so they said, oh, hey, we'll back the dollar with gold and convert, you know, make it convertible. And that way the world will have a currency that they can feel confident in to resume trade and all this kind of stuff. Well, the problem is, as the Marshall Plan kicked in, all these European countries started to actually have trade again. They accumulated dollars in their foreign currency reserves. And people like de Gaulle went, I could do a French accent, but I wonder, we don't need Z dollars. We need Z gold, right?
Mm-hmm.
We actually sent a battleship into New York City to get some of it, which is not unlike what the Germans were trying to do 10 years ago. Anyway, because of that convertibility, the U.S. lost about half that total by the late 1950s. And then by the after pledging more gold to the London Gold Pool in the 60s to try to defend the price peg, we were left with 8,133 metric tons by 1971. And that's when Nixon, you know, they all got together and said, we can't do this anymore. Well, I mean, we wouldn't have any left, right? By the late 70s. So yeah. Has that still been frittered away behind the scenes? That's what we don't know. Where this eventually heads, though, and why it's headed to China and this kind of de-dollarization theme that we've discussed now for, you know, really going back to the great financial crisis. Why wouldn't China want the same privilege that the U.S. enjoyed from the, you know, the late, right after World War II until now? If you're going to set up a system that does not rely on U.S. financial system as a hegemon, right, You know, you've seen what happened to Russia. They get sideways with the U.S. They get kicked out of SWIFT. They get their foreign currency reserves taken away. And you sit back as a leader in another nation like China or India, and you go, well, wait a second. It's probably only a matter of time before we get sideways with the U.S. over something. They'll do the same thing to us. We should set up our own system outside of this so that if the U.S. tries to pull the same stunt, kicking us out of SWIFT and all this stuff, well, we got this other thing we can fall back upon. So if you were the Chinese, knowing that that's inevitable, why wouldn't you accumulate as much gold as you have? Underestimate the number that you tell the world by like 90% just to kind of, you know, keep the game going. And then one day say, oh, now we've got 25,000 metric tons, just like the U.S. had at the end of World War II. And we're going to put some kind of semi-convertibility to our currency, which now allows all these other nations to maybe use our currency, create demand for our currency. This is the same exorbitant privilege that the U.S. enjoyed all these decades. That's where I think all of this is headed. That's why the gold has headed to China. And again, it just leaves the U.S. in a very unfortunate position going forward.
Well, I want to get to this big macro dot connecting, but before we do, just so we don't leave a thread hanging, last I looked, registered plus eligible, I'm going to make a number up, correct me, but silver suddenly is like flooded into COMEX. They claim to have, I think, 500 million ounces in there.
Yep.
The question is, where did that come from?
Right.
Besides the LBMA, right? Where could that have come from? There's no like pool of 500 million ounces I'm aware of that you could just sort of like siphon off. Is that... Would you agree with that speculation?
From what they tell us now at the base, that the CME group, which runs the COMEX, puts out that report you're talking about every day. Now, here's our 10 vaults, you know, and here's registered and here's eligible. But they also put at the bottom of that thing a disclaimer like you used to get on a sheet from a bookie. You know, this information is for entertainment purposes only, right?
They oh, really?
Yeah. They have a disclaimer on there that says, yeah, we think it's actually factual, but we can't be held accountable if it's not. So that's the first thing, right? Is it all just smoke and mirrors? Like delivery has always been there. You know, well, they delivered 50 million ounces this month. Well, did they, or did they just, you know, take it from bank A and give it to bank B, you know, slide it across a paper entry or whatever. So then you get to, like I said, the London, which is this physical metal trading hub, which is about as opaque as my morning coffee. They don't tell you. I mean, you can't really rely on their... wow, they give us now numbers once a month, Chris. Wow. Hey, thanks.
Yeah.
Now, they like to conflate everything together. They'll say, well, the vaults hold, like in gold, they'll say, we hold, you know, 8,000 metric tons of gold in the vaults of London or whatever it is. But like 5,000 of that is owned by the Bank of England. You know, His Majesty may not, maybe he leases it out, maybe he doesn't, I don't know. And then they've got a couple thousand metric tons that are allegedly in all these ETFs that are custodied and stored, for a very convenient reason, in London. So how much gold is there really in London that's available to be delivered? That's the what people call the free float. Okay. By using the LBMA's numbers that they give us, you could calculate that free float of silver to be less than 200 million ounces. That's really not very much. I know it's at 40,000 COMEX contracts worth at 5,000 ounces. Now, again, you're not necessarily settling COMEX contracts in London, but I'm just trying to give a scale and a scope of how much leverage there is in this pricing scheme. And for people to understand this, the leverage in these derivative-based pricing schemes is it's a fractional reserve system, like your bank, right? Yeah, everybody's seen, you know, It's a Wonderful Life and videos of bank runs and stuff, you know, where everybody shows up the bank at the same time wanting their cash. Well, the cash is not held in the safe, you know, it's all loaned out here and it's in this house over there and this business over there. So if the bank suddenly needs cash, they don't have it. You know, they might say, well, come back. We got so much in the safe. We can't give you all of that. You can give you part of your account. And they can do that if one or two people show up needing $10,000 in a day. But if everybody shows up wanting to drain their accounts, they don't have that cash. And that's the way London and New York operate these exchanges too. And that's where things might really begin to get interesting. Maybe as soon as later this year, next, we'll see. Can the current pricing scheme persist if suddenly the physical demand is such that it stretches that leverage to a breaking point and then everybody starts showing up like a bank run wanting their metal now to be first in line to get it out? So anyway, that, I don't know if that answers your question. It's kind of a long answer to a short question.
But again, in the spirit of the cop shooting video hypothesis, why are they so opaque with something that on the other hand, they tell us is this barbarous relic? It doesn't really have a role to play. It's just this sideshow. It doesn't really matter. And everything they do is to hide what the actual reality of gold is as much as possible in terms of who owns it. That should be easy to answer. Should be one of the, I could do this with a spreadsheet and an Excel macro, right? There's a bar, has a number, has your name on it, end of story, true it up, you know, once a month, and you're good to go. Should be easy.
Your question answers itself, yeah. I mean, the senator from Kentucky should be able to walk into a military base in his state anytime he wants, right? I mean, I live in Kansas. You would think the senator from Kansas can show up at Fort Riley anytime he wants. They're not going to keep him from going in and walking around. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, kind of answers itself, doesn't it?
It does. All right, now we have three big pieces of information came out. I just like to get your quick take or long take, however much take you want to take on the takes is fine by me. One, Saudi Arabia's central bank shows up on the SLV 13F saying they're now a purchaser on that. Two, we find out that Atav Acosta put this chart out and it went everywhere. Mohammed El-Erian and everybody reposted it, showing that gold is now a larger reserve asset than U.S. Treasuries and foreign official holdings, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Modi just came out, I think today or yesterday, and said, you know, we don't want these treasuries anymore. We'll have gold instead, right? India.
Yeah.
So what are we looking at here? It's starting. Those are creaking and popping sounds as far as I'm concerned. How are you reading that?
What was the first one again? Let's try to keep track of all three.
Well, the Saudi central bank showing up on.
Yeah, let's start there. All right.
Yeah.
Let's try to keep rolling. All right. And then after that, it's the government bond or treasuries versus gold and then Modi. Okay. The Saudi thing. To me, it's just a reflection of the financialization of everything. Okay, so the Saudis decide they want to own some silver. Now, maybe they, you know, were warned, you can't buy the actual thing. I'm sorry, we just don't have it to deliver to you, which may be the same case as Druckenmiller and Ray Dalio and all these other hedge funds, that when they buy gold or silver, they buy the ETF. We want the liquidity, you see. We want the price exposure. You're not actually buying the metal. And when push comes to shove, you don't own any of it either, right? As we said, all of that is custodied in London. The banks have their hands on it. Even the rules by prospectus, you and I, you know, or the Saudis, if they own shares of the SLV or the GLD, can't show up and say, hey, we've got a, you know, however many ounces equivalent here. We'd like to take delivery. No, only the banks that are what are termed as authorized participants have the ability to move metal in and out of those things. So the Saudis wanted price exposure like, you know, some of these prominent hedge funds have in the past, and that's what they've done. Okay, that's a bullish sign, but it's not a whole lot more than that, unless, of course, they only bought that thing because they were told they, you know, they couldn't do it otherwise. We've all heard, you've heard the story. Warren Buffett bought silver at $4 like you did or whatever, and 20 years ago. Okay, the government bond thing, that's a little bit, why is the gold on central bank balance sheets more in price, or what did they give you? Wasn't that like a nominal value or something, whatever it was? You saw those lines cross on that chart from Tavi Costa.
Well, it was in percentages, but it must be percentage of assets. So the gold must be valued fairly according to market somehow.
Right. And so it's a little bit of a reflection. One, there's clearly central bank demand. Couple hundred metric tons central bank demand every year for the last several years, exceeding anything we've seen over any other 3-year period in the past, and putting a serious bid under the price. And that's why prices kept going up, because if it was just a paper derivative price, as you know, as we've all seen, it would get smashed backwards from time to time. But they can't smash back too far because these central banks keep showing up and buying it. And it kind of puts the, you know, these bullion banks in a tough spot. So we know they're buying. We know the accumulation of actual metal is real. At present, that value crossing over versus treasuries is also, you know, it's a function of treasuries not being accumulated as quickly and actually being sold. But it's also then a function of the price. You know, the gold has gone, gold's gone up, almost doubled in the last 2 years. And so, you know, if you're going to mark that gold to market, which most of these other central banks do, not the U.S., then now all of a sudden, you know, where the treasuries are just kind of going sideways, you know, they're just going to, they fluctuate in price, but, you know, a 10-year treasury, you put in $10,000, you get $10,000 back when it matures. So part of that chart, I guess, is what I'm saying. Yeah, there's real central bank demand and accumulation of physical metal, but part of that chart is the accumulation of the price of gold. It's like I was seeing charts earlier this year about how the GLD, the big ETF. Oh, look how overbought this sector is because the GLD is, you know, it's $200 billion or whatever it is, higher than it's ever been. But the actual tonnage of the metal in that thing is still 20% below the highs from five mm-hmm. years ago. So when you look at the actual, you know, the value of the GLD, well, that's all just the price accumulation. It's not because everybody and their brother is buying gold. So that chart that you mentioned is a good thing. It's you know, that El Arian was putting out, the Tavi Costa originally drew up last week. It's a good thing. It gets a lot of attention, but there's some added context there. And with Modi saying he doesn't, you know, they're going to slow their purchases. Again, it's like what you and I have been preaching for, you know, all these years, Chris. I have dollar reserves, which are what I accumulate through my hard work. I get paid, I spend it, whatever I have left at the end of the month is my savings. And I have dollars. You put your savings in the bank, in the stock market, or into gold or whatever. You have the same thing. These countries just have it at a much larger level. They conduct trade in U.S. dollars. And if they have a positive trade balance, then they accumulate dollars over time. Okay, well, what are they going to do? It's the same paradox that we have. You can either sit in these dollars, which are slowly, you know, being devalued over time because we keep creating more and more and more of them, or you can diversify out of dollars. You can hold it in treasuries, but then, again, you got the same problem, or you can diversify into, you know, hard assets like gold. So what he's doing and what they're doing is just the same thing you and I have been discussing for years. Again, at the end of the day, though, Chris, we get into this situation where how much true physical gold is there with clear title and provenance that you're going to lay your hands on? It's mine. No, it's not. No, it's not yours. It's mine. No, there's 50 of us that all think we own it. Mm-hmm. That's the day that's going to get really interesting.
Well, to put one more piece on the whole Modi thing, obviously, so Trump kind of dissed India a couple ways, right? Said, okay, you know, he's been banging on him around tariffs. Mm. Think of that what you will. But he also tried to strong arm him and say, hey, we don't buy that Russian oil because, you know, we're having a scrap with Russia. And so we're going to dictate to you how you should behave and you have to march to our tune. And of course, as a very large, prosperous nation, they're like, that was a little dismissive. So next thing you know, you know, the actions sometimes have consequences. There was nothing more consequential, of course, than the Biden Treasury Department freezing the Russian sovereign assets. Right. That kicked all of this off. But I feel like the Modi thing is another sort of continuation of that same theme, which is this doesn't feel like an honorable way. Like, it feels not based in good trust and equal sort of stature, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, well, you know, here we are.
It creates that. Look, you know, when we talk about de-dollarization, there are a lot of people, smart people, you know, and I'm sure they're right. You know, the world needs dollars, and that preps up the dollar versus other currencies to mm-hmm. some regard, right? Like that, how the dollar index measures it. But when we talk about gold at whatever $3,500 an ounce, it's not the gold that's it's not the gold that's going up. The gold's not doing anything.
Mm-hmm.
It just now takes $3,500 to buy the same ounce that it took $2,500, you know, 2 years ago. It took $1,500, you know, 10 years ago. So it's not that the gold is changing. It's that purchasing power of the dollar that's changing. And that's why this de-dollarization thing, and you mentioned India, is such a big deal. The price of the dollar is a function of supply and demand, just like anything else. And this is what people need to, you know, make sure they understand. Because you can sit there, you can understand that if, like, let's say, for example, oranges, just pick something, and there's a bumper crop of oranges one year. There's just more orange we know what to do with. And at the same time, news breaks that orange juice is potentially carcinogenic. Okay? So you have this huge new supply of oranges and a falling demand for oranges. You know, Econ 101 means those supply-demand curves reset, and your new price is much lower. You got way more supply than the demand can pick up. Now, writ large, the U.S. dollar. So as countries move away and don't need as many dollars, you know, if this second system, this new system is set up where, you know, I don't need to trade in dollars anymore, says India, because we can buy our Russian oil and we can buy our products from China using a different currency to transact all that stuff. Well, that's now less demand for dollars, just like the oranges. Are they toxic and carcinogenic? Kinda. At the same time, the supply of said dollars is increasing, you could say, by $2 trillion a year as the deficits of the U.S. are out of hand. It's the same thing, man. Those supply-demand curves are resetting. Your dollar buys less and less. It's less and less valuable, which means these gold bars, this is not an actual gold bar, it's a piggy bank. Mm-hmm. But these gold bars, it's just going to take more and more dollars to acquire these things. I mean, there's 1,100 of them 10 years ago. It took 2,200 5 years ago. It takes 3,300 of it now. 5 years from now, probably $4,400 that it'll take. So that's why this dollar story, and like what you said about what's currently going on in India, that's where all of this is important. And well, those important, your people listening.
Those macro relationships are important. The price, demand, supply curves are really important. But, you know, so let's talk local politics for a minute. So Trump comes in with Bessent and he says, hey, with Doge and all that, with Elon, you know what? We're going to control the top line in this story. And then they give that up and they say, oh, we're going to grow the bottom line in this story. Okay. So this seems like kind of every president promises the same thing. We'll grow our way out of this. It has not happened yet in my entire adult life, right? And it's just getting worse and worse and worse every possible year. Now, against that backdrop, I came across this morning. So all the long bonds in Europe are blowing out right now. Japan's long bonds are blowing out. The United States 30-year is tagging the 5, you know, it's at 4.96 last I checked, but it's tagging the 5% mark.
Yeah.
It looks to me that that's starting to smell again like there's some kind of a fiat problem brewing here, because nobody wants to hold the long paper of any sovereign government anywhere right now in the West. How are you reading that?
And why would you, right? Because you can see
30 years, 2050, right. You know?
Oh, I'll take 5% interest every year for the next 30 years, which even those interest payments alone aren't, you know, that's not going to help you keep up with anything. And then you get your $25 back in 2055?
Yeah.
There's a great deal, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's a problem. In fact, about a year ago this time, the September FOMC, remember Jerry Powell cut the Fed funds rate by 50 basis points and the long end sold off. And, you know, you didn't get the whole curve going down by 50 basis points. You got this down and this went like this.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what you're seeing. I mean, Bank of England has been doing their own kind of QE and cutting rates, and now their yields are blowing out. And they are a whole separate problem, you know, with their pension system and the leverage they have and the gilt market and all that kind of stuff. Bank of Japan is having a problem. German bunds, as you mentioned, are all selling off on the long end. This is almost undeniably coming here, too, especially with Trump wanting to cut rates on the short end. And this is where I think we can start to connect the dots I mentioned earlier, Chris. You mind if I go off on a...
Please do.
All right. So I think, again, most people are pretty busy, right? They don't have time. This is what I tell people I do here. I kind of keep track of all this crap for you, right? And I'll tell you where I think all this is headed. Now, at the risk of being the metaphor I use all the time is A Beautiful Mind, remember Russell Crowe playing John Nash?
Yep.
And at the end, they go into his office and he's got all those post-it notes and all the strings. And of course, he was crazy. So hopefully That's not what they're going to figure out about me.
But also crazy smart, right?
Hey.
Could see patterns other people couldn't see.
Won a Nobel Prize in the end, right? Okay, so let's go all the way back to the beginning. Like you said, Trump, when he got elected, they were making all these promises about Doge and Musk, and they were going to balance the budget just by eliminating all the crap we've heard for decades, right? And it's like, well, we've heard this before. So you knew that wasn't going to work. And that, you know, went from $2 trillion in savings to $1 trillion in savings to $200 billion in savings to $100 billion in savings. And so they finally just had a hell of it. So now they're going to try to grow their way out of it. The Secretary of the Treasury has been on the record stating that, one, they need to monetize assets of the balance sheet. And that's part of this picture. To try to, you know, come up with deficit neutral ways to raise funds, to pay off some of the debt, that sort of thing. But Trump has been very clear that whether he can, if he can come up with a reason to fire Powell today, he would. But if anything, Powell's gone in May, right? And it's pretty obvious he's going to put in somebody dovish, right?
I mean, heck, they're having trouble firing somebody who lied on her mortgage applications.
Right.
At the Fed. So apparently it's hard to do.
Let's go back to that in a second, because I think that's interesting.
Yeah, okay.
But before we get there, Bessent has said he sees a future where the Fed needs to be totally restructured in how they do things. And a kind of a melding of Fed with Treasury as we try to navigate our way through these, you know, continuing. I mean, we are in pace this year. This fiscal year is going to end this month, and we're going to do 5 or 6 more. It would be $2 trillion. The deficit is going to be 5 or 6% higher than it was in that last year under Biden. Okay, so nothing has been done. The train has left the station and it ain't stopping. So they want to meld together the operation. And you kind of got a little of this under Biden when he took Mother Yellen, who had been running the Fed before Powell, and put her in charge of Treasury. Kind of see how this, we've been going this route in the first place. Here's what I think is going to happen. Trump wants lower interest rates for, you know, whatever reason, and he's going to get them. He's going to nominate the next Fed president, or he's stuffing the board already with people, you know, to force Powell's hand. But even if it makes it till May, this is what's happening next year. Well, then they run the risk, as we just said, that the long end's going to blow out, you know, and a yield curve that's instead of 1% to 3% is going to be 1% to 8%. And then you got a real problem, right? So when you meld together the Fed and the Treasury, what could that mean, Chris? Well, they've done this before. Coming out of World War II with record high, or at least previous record high, debt to GDP levels, the Fed instituted a policy of yield curve control, where they just simply said, I mean, think of it this way. We are buyers of everything over 3%. There's going to be a cap on the 10-year note at 3%. Kind of like the way the London gold pool worked. Every time gold moved above 35, you know, the countries in the gold pool would sell some gold, you know, to bring it down. Every time we went below 35, they'd buy it back and bring it back up. The Fed on yield curve control would kind of do the same thing. They'd say anytime the 10-year note gets above 3%, we're buyers. If it gets above 4%, we're buyers on the 30-year long bond. And they're going to hold that down, which is extraordinarily bullish for the precious metals. In a sense, what they try to do is they're trying to pay off yesterday's debts with the cheaper dollars of tomorrow. It's a very dollar devaluation, very negative real interest rate environment to try to manage it this way. They might not even, Chris, have to actually buy any treasuries to begin with. You remember in the COVID crisis, that Monday morning, whatever it was, the 12th of or 19th of March, whatever it was, this alphabet soup of new programs that the Fed came out with, they cut rates to zero, and they said, we're going to do this, we're going to do this, we're going to do this, we're going to do this. One of those, they were going to buy corporate bonds, which now doesn't seem so crazy since we now own Intel. But anyway, they were going to buy corporate bonds. They never did. Maybe they did after like a year or two, but they never did, just because the threat of them buying them put a bid under the corporate bond market. And so they never reached that threshold where the Fed had to. And that may be initially how yield curve control works. It's just this policy. And if bond investors know, well, the Fed's got my back. You know, I can go ahead and buy these long bonds at 4% because the Fed's not going to let them go down any worse. They might just be able to talk it into existence. But this is what's coming. I mean, like I said, I knew there was going to be a long answer. But this is what I think they're telling you is coming next year as a way to try to manage, you know, the debt and the deficit and everything else going forward. It's very bullish for the metals, brother.
Which means that anybody, say, all those treasuries that are offshore, if somebody says, I really would rather sell these to the Fed at 3%, which is a pretty good capital appreciation or something. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Next thing you know, the Fed's going to be printing a lot of money again.
Mm-hmm. Is that so, modern monetary theory stuff, in a way?
It is, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Any chance that maybe the Treasury just issues money directly, right, to compete with the Federal Reserve note?
Yeah. You know, people thought maybe that's what the central bank digital currencies could be, you know, all this kind of shuffling. You know, a lot of people think that's the purpose of all this stable coin stuff, right? Because all these stable coins, if you can pump those up, then that's demand for treasuries as well, because they've all got to be backed by something so that they, you know, have an asset to hold the price at one. Mm-hmm. And it also, hey, that's competition for anything the Chinese or whatever might institute, right? Hey, here's a way we can still keep some dollar demand, treasury demand, by pumping.
Sure.
So I think a lot of these things all seem to connect. So it gets to then the case of Goon Cooked, as I like to call her. I call all the Fed governors goons. she's Goon Cooked.
Very kind of you, by the way.
Yeah, exactly. Kind. So anyway, you know how, Chris, I mean, you've been an observer of this for years like I have. Take, for example, when there's cases that go before the Supreme Court, they're usually handpicked. You know, they got all these people looking for, okay, this one has the right qualities to it. If we can start moving this through all the appeals processes and get it to the Supreme Court, we might be able to attack precedent or set a new precedent because of the specific peculiarities of this case. It's like the, you know, Republicans and conservatives wanted to attack the right of privacy Roe versus Wade thing for 5 decades. But they never had the case to do it until they found the Dobbs thing. And then up through the courts it goes, and here you go. And they get the court, you know, has a conservative bias or whatever. But all you got to get these cases that attack. I'm a legal scholar, but it sure seems, you know, this is how they do it. All right, so they had to figure that Cook would challenge Trump's authority to fire her, right? She wasn't just going to get up and say, ah, you got me. Again, it's like what you said. She's got the documents, right? Right, she used to roll out and say, look, here's my mortgage documents. I didn't do any fraud here. But she's not done that, so there must be something more there in the midst. But she's not just going to take it land down. So, you know, last Friday they had the initial hearings in a D.C. court about whether Trump can fire her or not. And eventually that, whoever, whatever gets decided is going to go to the D.C. Court of Appeals. And whatever gets decided there is then going to go to the Supreme Court. And we might actually, if there's some planning to this, eventually kind of rule upon the actual constitutionality of the Federal Reserve Act of 2013. Because if the executive branch doesn't have the control over this private institution to say who's going to run it, well, who really does run it? The institution itself? So anyway, I think all of this melds together into this big ball, you know, that, and all these post-it notes on my wall as to where they're taking us next year.
Well, it's a bold move, Cotton, but I am, you know, I'm an end the Fed kind of guy. I think that it was a disaster from the founding. I think that, listen, if you're going to have a Fed or equivalent, you have to have the right to have transaction level audits at any point in time. Because it's too much power. It's just the cookie jar is too seemingly bottomless, and we have no insight into how they're spending their money. It was in 1983 or 4 or something. I forget. Anyway, you know why we don't have M3? Because M3 tells you offshore money creation. Because it was telling us stuff we didn't want to see, and they specifically forbid any insight into the Fed's offshore activities. I'm like,
right.
What?
No, we can't have that anymore. No,
and wouldn't you know it, because I'm this kind of a guy, I watch every single 10-year auction go off without fail, whether we're issuing $100 billion that quarter or month or day or $5 billion. They go off at a bid to cover of 2.41 plus or minus 0.03, right? Every time, 2.41. But wouldn't you know it, seems to be a little less activity, Luxembourg, the Caymans, yeah, step in and buy the balance, right? And I'm a little suspicious. I would just like to not be suspicious. I think we should have an audit of the Fed and find out if they aren't wiring money to places that they shouldn't be, to just to maintain the appearance of strong demand for U.S. paper, which I understand. I could see how they could mission creep into that as like something that they have to do, right? For the good of humanity, you know?
Right.
Market stability. But we should be auditing the Fed. So this feels like Trump is nibbling away at their power and autonomy. Maybe this gets us someplace that I would approve of.
Right. Or maybe it just opens up a whole dark thing and then they just close the door and go, nope, can't go there. Greater good, for the greater, you know, keep your necks for plate spinning, all the people with their 401ks in the market and how, you know, that would be, again, it's like the Fort Knox thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's no different, right? If they let Rand Paul and some reporters in there and they find out, you know, they break some seals on the vaults and wait a second, there's just like some spiders crawling around.
Yep. Or there's some bars in there stamped with the Iraqi central bank or maybe Libya's, you know, where did all that gold go?
Yeah.
Remember those tanker trucks with the guys holding and where did it go? It's weird. Okay. I hate to do this. I see we're out of time. So
no, you're right. We are. Shoot.
Okay. While we're here, Craig, how do people follow you? Where do they go?
Well, thank
you. Access your awesome report.
This is what we do every day. It's just a website that you buy a subscription to. It's for now, at least. I'm going to have to raise prices again soon. I've only done it once before. But for now, it's only $15 a month. I think it might go to 18 or 19. We'll see. Mm-hmm. But it, like I said, I'm kind of everybody's eyes and ears, which is I know a lot of what you do at your site. Mm-hmm. You know, people pay me just to sit here all day and try to make sense of it all through a post in the morning that I write. And a podcast in the afternoon that I record. And, you know, if anything, I get a lot of compliments these days, you know, as gold's breaking out and silver's back above 40. And they're like, oh, thank you so much for all this. And I'm like, well, I really didn't do anything other than continually remind you over the last decade that the math is the math. In the market, your stockbroker, your neighbor will tell you the math isn't the math and everything's just fine. Just keep buying, you know, stocks and all this kind of stuff. And the math has always been the math. And there's, we call it the end of the great Keynesian experiment. There's a point that's coming where this debt-based system just can't support itself anymore outside of just this increased perpetual motion machine that's a money printer. The book that I have right here, When Money Dies, you know, that everybody was reading about the Weimar Republic, you know, 15 years ago, still a valid case. So this is what we do there. And again, if you think you need somebody to do all this for you, to keep you ahead of the game, that's what I do. But I, you know, if I leave a thought with anybody, yeah, this is exciting. Gold's breaking out again. If it continues the pattern that it has held for the last 2 years, it's probably going to $3,900 or $4,000 an ounce before it consolidates again. And everybody's all excited about silver and all this kind of stuff. That's great. But why is it already moving? Why are we having the second great year in a row for gold that we've never had two great years in a row like this? Because the signs are all there. Again, you're being told, I think, where they're taking us as soon as later this year, early next, into next year. And so you think gold is expensive now. You think, you know, whatever. If I'm right about where they're taking us, we're going to look back and go, wow, there was a time not too long ago it only took $3,500 to buy an ounce of gold. Huh? I guess we should have been buying some. Yeah. Yeah, you should.
Yeah, I'm old enough to remember when it was too expensive at $500, $700, $800, $1,000, $1,200, $1,500, $1,800, and on until here we are, and that will continue. So with that, thank you, everybody, for listening. By the way, if you don't understand the landscape, you could get blindsided. So Craig's got an amazing newsletter, helps you stay on track with what's going on. And then please, 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 you have to manage your wealth with an eye to the actual risks, not listening to your neighbor, maybe your stockbroker either, and making up your own mind about how you're going to manage for the risks as they actually are The writing's on the wall. They're going to print, and they're going to print more. That's what they do. Nothing personal, but it's going to come. And so thank you, Craig, for all your insights here today.
Dude, thank you for all of yours that you've shared with my side over the years. We couldn't have gotten through it without you, so thank you for all you do, too.